Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, but we're not going to take any callers this hour because we have with us a very, very special guest. In fact, he's not an infrequent guest. In fact, he's getting to be a regular guest here on Radio Liberty. His name is Dr. James Herson. He is a professor of law at Trinity College of Law in Southern California. He's the author of The Coming Collision and Government by Decree and a recent article in the newspaper. We won't have time to talk about that, where he goes into the background of the consideration of international law and what's going on with NATO and Yugoslavia and Kosovo. But right now we're going to be talking about the Declaration of Independence. Dr. Herson, are you there?
I am, and it's a pleasure to be a frequent guest on Radio Liberty.
Well, thank you so very much. And we really wanted to get into the background of the Declaration of Independence because certainly this is one of the four major documents, the founding documents of America. And without an understanding of the Declaration of Independence, it's impossible to understand either the Constitution or the Bill of Rights and what our founding fathers were really thinking when they wrote up our Constitution, which became the foundation upon which our republic rests. So why don't you go into the background of the Declaration of Independence? Dr. Herson has certainly come up with a very, very convenient way of remembering this. And for our listeners, we'd like you to get out a pencil and paper and just start writing down what you're going to learn tonight, because this is going to be presented as if it were a class. And so I'm here to learn, and I hope you will be as well. Why don't you pick it up from there?
That's right, and take careful notes because there'll be a test on this.
Right.
No, actually, you know, we're all tested in a way because the Declaration of Independence is sort of the foundation on which our system is based. And one of the things I think that's been lost, it's sort of misunderstood, is how important the Declaration of Independence is really to the whole legal system in America, because it's almost like the birth certificate. In fact, it is the birth certificate of our country. And in that sense, it's very similar to when a company is created, a corporation. It's created through what are called articles of incorporation. And the articles are sort of like the birth certificate. And then the bylaws are the sort of guiding legal principles that spring from those articles. And the bylaws must be interpreted within the framework of the articles. And well into the 20th century in American law, the Declaration of Independence guided the interpretation of the Constitution. And these two documents were viewed as interdependent and really inseparable kinds of documents. And even the Constitution itself, when in Article 7, refers to the date in 1987 as, you know, the year of our Lord, but also refers to the 12th year of independence, referring back to the birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence being adopted by Congress at the time, July 4th, 1776. And when states were admitted to the United States, the State Enabling Acts required the states to commit both to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And you can see that in the statutes themselves, particularly for states like Colorado, Nevada, Nebraska, and Oklahoma, the states that came in later. It's interesting, just a little note about Thomas Jefferson, who was the original writer of the Declaration, although it was a collaborative effort. The last words of John Adams, when he died, were, "Thomas Jefferson still survives." And John Adams died on July 4th, 1826, and he wasn't aware of the fact that Jefferson had actually passed away 5 hours before. And Jefferson earlier that evening had awakened and said, "Is it the fourth yet?" And someone told him yes, and then he sort of went back to sleep and passed away. And it was on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and American sovereignty that both of these men passed away on July 4th. It's an amazing anecdote, really.
And, you know, one of the things that nobody had ever commented to me, but, of course, one of my favorite dissertations was the Gettysburg Address. In fact, I gave it in college when I was 16 years old, and my public speaking teacher got up after I'd given the Gettysburg Address and said, I've heard many renditions of the Gettysburg Address during my years as a professor, but that indeed was the worst rendition I've ever heard. But I will never forget, you know, that 67 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And you go back 67 years ago, well, that was the Declaration of Independence that Lincoln was talking about. But you see, we never mention that because, of course, there are so many mentions within the Declaration of God, and those people who would destroy the Christian or Judeo-Christian foundation of this once great nation certainly want to eliminate any reference to the Declaration or to the fact that our freedoms came from God.
Oh, that's so true. And the Founding Fathers, in many of their letters, would refer to the year as, say, the fourth year of the sovereignty of the United States. And that would always relate back to the Declaration of Independence. So it was very clear that our founders thought it was very important. John Quincy Adams said that this was the platform upon which the Constitution of the United States had been erected. He said its virtues, its republican character, consisted in its conformity to the principles proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence. So he's talking about the fact that the Declaration of Independence informs the Constitution. In an early Supreme Court case, Gulf Colorado and Santa Fe Railway Company versus Ellis in 1897, described the Constitution as the letter of the law and the Declaration as the spirit of the law, saying, "It is always safe to read the letter of the Constitution in the spirit of the Declaration of Independence." And interesting, you know, you talked about our Judeo-Christian and theistic heritage. You know, the Declaration mentions God four times within the document. And the first one is God as the law giver. It calls God when it refers to the laws of nature and of nature's God. And in the second, it talks about God the maker of all things, because it calls God the creator who endowed us with our unalienable rights. And the third reference is to a judge, the supreme judge of the world. And then the fourth is God as a protector, divine providence to whom we look for protection. And that's so important because our Christian heritage is an essential part, really, of understanding historically, culturally, politically, and legally how this country was put together, because it's essential to the understanding. That's why when you refer to that, it being removed from our culture has really removed the understanding, the essence of, you know, the fundamental notions and morals and principles of our country. You know, it was ministers, men of the cloth in the pulpits, that really were laying the groundwork for the spirit that allowed the American Revolution. There was a famous evangelist named George Whitefield, who was alive, and during the period between 1736, he died in 1770, he preached 18,000 sermons, and this was during the period called the Great Revival, where Benjamin Franklin noted he would walk down streets of towns and hear hymns coming out of houses everywhere. And there was a spirit of independence because of the way these ministers preached. As a matter of fact, 100 years before there were any tensions between the U.S. and Britain, Charles II, who was the King of England at the time, was warned by his advisors that these American ministers either need to be tamed or regulated or be replaced with Episcopalian priests. And these conflicts, you know, sort of continued under Charles II and James II until William and Mary issued this Declaration of Indulgence in 1689, which brought a sort of a peaceful period. But in 1760, the famous King George III came to power, and he said, you know, we've got to tame these colonies. And so the first thing he did was increase the size of British military and then decide that the colonists would have to pay for it. And various tax acts were passed, and the Townshend Acts, the famous acts, extended taxes beyond just the cost of military, and then finally, most of them were repealed except for dealing with tea, and the famous East Indian Tea Company was excluded from duties while American tea companies were not, which created a very difficult situation economically, and that caused the Boston Tea Party, which resulted in King George shutting down the largest port in America in Boston. And during this period, the media was controlled primarily by forces sympathetic to Britain. And so an alternative media source had to be set up, much like Radio Liberty and much like the Internet.
Like it really was the committees of correspondence, wasn't it?
That's right. Samuel Adams set that up. And what I love is, and I guess today you can't find this in history books, but the slogan for the committees of correspondence was, "No king, but King Jesus." Now that's not, I don't think we'll find that in politically correct history books.
And in fact, many of the soldiers used to make that same statement, "No king, but King Jesus."
That's right. And so the historical background is then finally the Second Continental Congress, which was, in fact, the government of the colonies from 1775 to 1788, met in May of 1775, and King George III had not replied to the petition for a number of grievances that had been sent to him from the First Continental Congress. And so, in August of 1775, King George basically issued a proclamation that was his version of an executive order saying that American citizens were engaged in open and avowed rebellion. So these tensions just grew. And in May of 1776, the Continental Congress found out that the king was negotiating treaties with the German states to hire mercenaries to fight in the U.S. And so many Americans were starting to get more and more convinced that the colonies were being treated like they were a separate country. And, you know, around that time, a very important work came out from a pamphleteer named Thomas Paine called Common Sense. And it just sold, by the thousands and influenced thoughts very greatly. You know, these are the times that Tryman sold. He said, "Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. But we have the consolation with us that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." And one of the great things for our time, he said, "Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must undergo the fatigue of supporting it." And so things really began to heat up in 1776 in June. And in June 7th, that Continental Congress, having a meeting in Philadelphia, had a delegate from Virginia named Richard Henry Lee, who had a resolution saying, you know, "I think it's time for the United States to declare independence." And there were still some delegates that had loyalty to Britain, and so they kind of postponed consideration. But while they did, they decided to appoint a committee to draft a statement that would present to the world the colony's case for independence. And so they appointed two gentlemen from New England, John Adams of Massachusetts and Roger Sherman of Connecticut, and two men from the middle colonies, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania and Robert R. Livingston of New York, and one young Southerner, Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. And, of course, he was the youngest gentleman on the committee, and the elders dished off the work and delegated to him and said, "Hey, Thomas, you go draft this. Give us a rough draft," which he worked. And he was quite a scholar with a humongous library and very familiar with the philosophy of government of the time, and he put together, he was working for several days and composed a rough draft. And this rough draft was then revised by Adams, and then he gave it to Franklin, who then revised it again, and then all five of them revised. So this was a very much collaborative effort, and before it ever went to Congress, there were 47 alterations and the insertion of three complete paragraphs. And before they voted on it, on independence, the Congress then continued to make changes, so they made another 39 changes, which is one of the reasons it's such a brilliant, incredible document, because these great minds combined and collaborated, and I believe were very much influenced by divine inspiration because of what they came up with, which is such a masterpiece. And they, of course, on July 4th, Congress adopted this declaration, and it was a gentleman named John Dunlap that printed it up. 24 copies are known to exist today, two of which are in the Library of Congress, and one of those were was George Washington's personal copy. And so that's really the backdrop of how this amazing document came into existence.
Now, you have divided this up into, what, five separate parts to help people to understand the concepts that are laid out here?
Yes, you know, I was thinking about it. I actually looked over some old notes that I had, and I noticed there was this sort of scholarly designation that was made to the Declaration. I think one was called a preamble, and one was called the, you know, pre-body and the body and all this, and I started looking at it from the point of view of what was Jefferson trying to accomplish with these five sections, and I came up with my own classification, but I said, the first section, really, I called the justification for separation. Actually, it sounds like Jesse Jackson named it. But it states that what the document would do was explain why it was necessary for the American colonies to leave the British Empire. That's the first section. And then the second section talks about the moral and philosophical basis for independence. That's the most important section. It sets out principles that were recognized. It was part of the moral consensus of the world, and explains why it is the right of the citizens and the duty to throw off this government, which is what they're ultimately leading to. And then the third section, and it's very legalistic, but Jefferson was a lawyer, is, I call it, the indictment, because it's giving evidence of this long train of abuses and usurpations that were heaped upon the colonists by King George III. And the fourth section is sort of a required section, because they wanted to, these were all former Englishmen, and they wanted to reference their British brethren and let them know that they at least had appealed to them. And that's, I call that the denunciation. And the last section I analogized to, again, a business document, but in a corporation, it's very much like a corporate resolution, where a corporation will say, resolved, we hereby seek to acquire another company, or something like that. What are we going to do? And so the last section explains, after explaining the justification, the moral basis, the indictment, the denunciation, it explains what has to be done, what action has to be taken. And that, of course, is the independence of a separate state. And we can go through each section in more detail.
Then let's start with the very beginning. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitles them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Now, that's the justification, isn't it?
That's right. And it's interesting because it's a paragraph composed of one sentence. And it's an amazing thing looking at this because of the collaborative effort. It's just everything about it, every word really has significance. And the opening phrase sets the American Revolution in this big panorama. It says that it's in the course of human events, that this is not some trifling matter. This is a serious matter. And the laws of nature and of nature's God really refers to this wonderful, it's more than a philosophy, it's the truth, that notion that law is really just a shadow of something that is universal called natural law or the laws of nature that comes from God, that through reason we can in fact realize the universal notion of right and wrong. So the laws of nature refer to natural law, and of nature's God is those laws that are revelation, that really refers to the Bible, to divine revelation, that this combination of laws of nature, which, by the way, both of those concepts are referred to in Paul's epistle to the Romans. He refers to a law that can be determined through reason, and, of course, the revelation law of the Scriptures. But both of these entitle America to a separate and equal station among the powers of the earth. And this sanction from the opinions of mankind, the introduction dignifies the revolution as something that involves principle, and it proclaims that a moral legitimacy, and it never mentions England or America by name. So it's an amazing thing. And also the word necessary in 18th century language had a kind of a tone of involving deterministic overtones, almost a destiny, divine destiny, that this is something that is separate and distinct from or beyond the control of human agents. And then what's very important is in that justification section, it calls one people, which is Americans, and another, which is British. So it reinforces the idea that breaking the political bands between these two people, that they're two distinct groups, and helps to set in motion the tone that this is already really a separate nation, that we're not talking about a civil war, because this was the most powerful military in the world that we potentially were taking on as America, and it would be very helpful if we could receive assistance, perhaps from France or from other foreign sources, and it would be less likely to get that assistance if it was viewed as a civil war. In other words, within a sovereign nation as opposed to two sovereign nations. And also defining Americans as a separate people helped under 18th century philosophy to justify the idea of the revolution, because if American Great Britain were looked upon as one people, Congress itself would have difficulty justifying revolution, because obviously a significant portion of the citizenry, the British citizens, would have been against it. But in looking at them as separate people, if we had the American support, Congress could justify it.
And then, of course, wasn't there a great deal of writing at that time, for instance, John Locke, these ideas of the laws of nature and nature's God, and Blackstone in his commentaries on the laws of England, and Samuel Rutherford, who had written about all men being created equal, and Montesquieu, and all of these were basically Christian writers talking about man's right to be free. And wasn't it really this Christian concept of the fact that we should be ruled by God and not by government that really led up to them making this break with England?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, there are so many quotes from early Americans. I remember there's one by Patrick Henry that said, that the nation was founded by Christians on the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, there's so much of the Reformed Christian tradition inherent in this philosophy. And you mentioned Blackstone's commentaries. Blackstone's commentaries were almost the sole book that lawyers used in law school and judges used to determine, you know, rights and liabilities in just normal civil and criminal matters. And it was the Bible of lawyers in essence, and Blackstone's commentaries is soundly based on biblical concepts. It has all kinds of references to scripture. And, yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that influences this section, and even more so, the next section that we're going to go to.
All right, why don't we get to that? Because the next section, I think, is so vitally important.
And I call that the moral basis for independence, or the philosophical basis.
Okay, now, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
See, I think your teacher was wrong. I think you do a wonderful job.
Well, that was a long time ago. I was 16 years old. I was the youngest boy in the class, and most of the people there were maybe 23, 24. It was during the Second World War, and all these pretty co-eds were there, and I was trying to be very impressive, and I did a terrible, terrible job. I'm sure my professor was right. But it gave me an incentive to try to do better and to learn how to talk, and so I really owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude.
So we'll have to thank him for Radio Liberty. Maybe I wouldn't be here. And, you know, and this is, the closest thing I can think of is, it's like a Beethoven symphony. It's, people say when they listen to Beethoven's music that it's inevitable, that you wouldn't change one note. And that's what it seems like, and particularly in this section, this is five sentences, 202 words altogether, and, you know, you mentioned John Locke. He wrote a treatise, the Second Treatise of Government, which influenced Jefferson and the others very much, but they were able to really distill and compress the complex ideas of John Locke really into this wonderful, incredible paragraph, and so many things are in here. One of the things that's important is that just the first words that say, we hold these truths to be self-evident. You know, what could be a greater contrast from today's relativism that, in fact, this document believes in truth, that there is such a thing as absolute truth that can be, in fact, self-evident, even to believe in truth, especially today when we live in such an age of deceit, it appears as though our modern culture does not embrace truth. And then, of course, the other thing is there's these two pillars that the American system is built on. And this answers two fundamental questions. And the questions are these. Where do our rights come from? And secondly, where does government get its power? And here it answers that. It says that we are endowed by our Creator with these unalienable rights, that rights are implanted in us. They're inherent in us. They come from a divine source. And the second question, where does government get its power? Well, they get their power from us, from the consent of the governed. And those two things are what our system is built on. Limited government. The idea that through the social contract that we named the Constitution, that the federal government gets only that power which we specifically state in the document, and no more. And therefore, we have the rights, and we benevolently give some of it to the government, and those rights do not come from the state. Now, that's in great contrast, of course, to the philosophy of the United Nations and the philosophy that we see reflected in treaties and international documents, etc.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break here, and when we get back, Dr. Herson will get into this second part, the moral philosophy behind the Declaration of Independence. Dr. Stan here, and of course this is the time in our programs when we always have to remind you that we are listener-supported. And of course it's rather expensive to be able to be on 25 stations across America, and we buy time from most of the stations. Some of the stations give us a very good deal, and some of them charge us top dollar. But of course, we've targeted specific areas. We've targeted California because this is where we live, and where our programs are heard in Northern California on major station, at Southern California on a major station, here in the Central Coast on several stations, and then of course stations all across America, internet, shortwave, and we've accomplished what we have because there are people like you out there in the listening audience who believe in what we're doing and want to help us to continue getting out the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So if you believe that we have a message that's important, you believe that America was founded as a Christian nation, and that the foundations of our freedom are based upon the principles laid out in the scriptures and laid out within our founding documents, and that we're losing those and we're moving rapidly towards tyranny, and you'd like to do something. Don't just sit around and grouse and say, well, what can I do? You can do something. Everybody can do something. And one of the things you can do is help us. We have a voice, and when you are a member of the Radio Liberty family, you become part of that voice. And you become part of our effort to reach people either by radio or by newspaper, by newsletter, and our newsletter is going to be going out very, very soon. That's going out to not only the Radio Liberty supporters, but we send it to many of the movers and shakers across America, and many times we'll pick up other people's publications, and there will be our information. But you see, we're selling ideas, ideas upon which freedom is based. And so it's as simple as picking up your telephone right now and dialing 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. And for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you'll get our four best tapes of the month. You'll get our newsletter, and you can become part of our team, part of the effort to try to bring the message of the truth to people across America. You can write to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. That's Post Office Box 95063. Pardon me, that's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. But we hope that many of you out there will want to join in this epic struggle in which we're currently engaged, an epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God based upon individual liberty can long endure. And this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. James Herson, of professor of law at Trinity Law School in Southern California, and we're talking about the second section of the Declaration of Independence. And basically, Dr. Herson is divided into five sections. The first is the justification for the Declaration. The second is the moral and philosophical basis. The third is the indictment of King George III. The fourth is the denunciation, and the fifth is the resolve. So we're into part two, the part that starts with the words, we hold these truths to be self-evident.
Yes, and we were saying, you know, we hold these truths, such a contrast from this relativist, kind of atheist, secular, humanistic philosophy that says there is no truth. Whatever, you know, is true for you may not be true for the other person, that notion of relativism. And it's just refreshing to look back at the founders and know that they held that there was absolute truth that was self-evident. And here again, this most important section of the Declaration has sort of five propositions, five truths.
I'm going to ask if Kevin could come in here. We may have lost our contact with the internet. Go right ahead, Doctor.
Oh, sure. There are five truths that are in this section. One of them is that all men are created equal. And, of course, that's all people are created equal, that the notion that God creates people with equal opportunities and with equal standing under the rule of law, that the rule of law looks at all people impartially. And the second proposition is they, all these people, are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, meaning, as we talked about earlier, that rights don't come from the state. That's in such great contrast. You know, for example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights will talk about a fundamental right, such as freedom of speech, but it will add a catch. It'll say, well, this right is subject to those restrictions that are provided by law. And that's so different from the way our system is in the Bill of Rights, where it says Congress shall make no law. Congress has no power to interfere with your freedom of speech. And because those rights are unalienable. And actually, that was a typographical error in the Declaration of Independence, but we keep it anyway, the unalienable as opposed to inalienable. But the notion is that you can't transfer these rights. That the word alienable means to transfer. So like you could transfer a piece of real estate, a right to ownership, but you can't transfer these fundamental rights like freedom of speech. And we don't get those rights from the state. We get them from a divine source, from God. And the fourth proposition is that to secure these rights, to make sure that they're protected, that governments are instituted among men. And where does the government get its power? It derives the power from the consent of the governed. This is the social contract theory. This follows John Locke's second treatise on government, and it's that other pillar of our system, the notion of limited government, that there is no power other than the power that comes from the specific provisions of the social contract of the Constitution. And then the last proposition is, after setting all this in motion, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, what ends? Well, that is securing our unalienable rights. It is the right of the people to do one of two things, either alter it or abolish it. And then, of course, there are many in this country who feel that things are just fine the way they are, even though there's de facto law building up and even though there's a departure from these principles. But if we felt as though our government is destructive of these ends, I think we at least have the right to alter it. And in my view, it's to restore and to return, as Radio Liberty is fighting to do with its broadcasts. And all of these propositions are set forth, and each one sort of leads into the other. All men being created equal, endowed by their creator with these rights. What are the rights? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And by the way, I think the order is no accident. The right to life is first, and the right to liberty and pursuit of happiness is second, and right, and life being life from conception to natural death, that life is sacred when you have a theistic paradigm, a theistic worldview. And then that once we identify the rights, that to secure the rights, governments are instituted and they derive their power from the consent of the government. And if the government becomes destructive, we are able to alter or abolish. And once that we have our justification, we have our moral basis, now we turn to the next section, which I call the indictment.
Okay, fine. And that starts with the history of the present king of Great Britain. Is that where you start that?
Let's see, I have to look at it myself. actually, that's the transitional
right.
Thing. That's right.
All right, fine. So the history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. And to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world, and then, of course, they list all of the things that King George has done.
Right. Now, in the previous section, the moral basis, because of the moral consensus of the time, the truths stated were self-evident. And Thomas Jefferson, being a lawyer, now he's getting more legalistic, and he's looking at not something that's self-evident, but something that has to be proven. And therefore, he has a bill of particulars documenting the king's repeated injuries and usurpations, and it lists 28 of these grievances. It's kind of interesting. There are three types of grievances, and it parallels, in a way, some of the grievances that we currently have against the present government. You know, the first group, there's 12 of them, talk about abuses of the king's executive power. He was suspending laws and dissolving legislatures and obstructing justice. Can you imagine? And maintaining a standing army during peacetime, very much like we have today the abuse of the presidential power with executive orders, with the use of military, without congressional participation, implementing international treaties without congressional required congressional ratification or approval. It's very similar. The second group are attacks on the king for combining with others to subject America to unconstitutional measures. And they're really talking about the British Parliament, but that maybe is analogous to when our government combines with these international organizations to affect American sovereignty. It's very similar. And the third talk about the king's violence and cruelty in waging war against the American subjects. So it's building. And that one, for the most part, hasn't happened on a grand scale, but one could compare that with things like Waco and Ruby Ridge, which at least are evidences of small battles that are against American citizens. So there are some parallels to the time that this was drafted to today's time. And one of the very first part of the indictment says about King George, he has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Well, certainly we've had presidents, and our current president, veto legislation that would be good for America and oppose, for one example of that is the veto on the ban on partial birth abortion. There's one that says he has called together legislative bodies and was attempting to fatigue them into compliance with his measures. I don't know what's going on with this Congress, but they certainly seem to be fatiguing into compliance.
I think that he's got things on all of them. I think that's the truth of the matter. We know he has all these illegal FBI files. We know he has investigators going out and investigating them. We know he has James Carville and Larry Flint digging up dirt on the members of the Congress. And whether they're fatigued or whether they're just cowardly, I don't know. But there are very, very few of them who have the courage to stand. And he's embarrassed Congressman Dan Burton, Henry Hyde, Helen Shenoweth. He's tried to embarrass Barr. It's part of a program, and it's very difficult to stand up when you're dealing with a man who has the power of the Secret Service and the FBI and the CIA and the National Security Administration, and certainly the whole of the radical left will go after anybody who doesn't go along with the government and with the president. I would say that might be fatiguing people.
Yeah, I think it's an understatement. And then, of course, he has obstructed the administration of justice in George's case by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. And, of course, obstruction of justice was one of the charges in the impeachment trial. And then this is an interesting one. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. Well, I think we've just seen the military being used independent of the civil power without a formal declaration of war. And we see that quite often in American history, although this one has a unique quality to it.
Maybe we can discuss that some evening about because you're talking about what's happening as far as NATO and Kosovo and Yugoslavia.
Yes. Oh, we'll have to do that.
Okay.
And for imposing taxes on us without our consent. That's an interesting topic. timeless charge. And then a blanket statement, we're taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government. And I think clearly what we've seen is an attempt to fundamentally alter the forms of our government. And that's the, you know, one of my missions, and I know one of yours, is to awaken Americans to that so that we can understand the uniqueness of America and so we can preserve and restore the essence of our system.
Okay.
And so I think that's probably, you know, what the grievances are about. It's interesting, you know, the words that are used are very emotional, and they end with this king's violence and cruelty, where they're talking about the war grievances, because at the time, historically, many Americans didn't suffer the physical and economic hardships of war with Britain, and so there was a need to get their attention, you know, to bring this to their doors. Thomas Paine said that Americans, the evil of British domination had to be sufficiently brought to the doors of Americans. And so the idea of this wickedness of King George III was to arouse the passions of readers and thereby sort of solidify the support of Americans.
Okay, fine. And then, of course, we get to the denunciation.
Yeah, and the denunciation was sort of a requirement because, as I said, you know, American citizens were close to their British brethren. I mean, they were all of English culturally and had left Britain, most of them anyway. And they said that they had, in fact, appealed in vain to the people of Great Britain. And they said, you know, nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. And we have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations. So that the American citizens had not just appealed to the government, but had appealed to the people of Great Britain.
And then, of course, in the resolution, we suddenly see them talking about appealing to the supreme judge of the world. In other words, they've appealed to the people of Great Britain, but in the final statement, what you refer to as the resolution, now they appeal to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intention.
That's right.
And do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies.
Yeah, after justifying this action, after setting forth the moral and philosophical basis in the most important section, the second section, and after setting forth the facts in the indictment and setting forth that they had appealed to the British citizens, now all that remained was for Congress to say, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about this? And that's where they have a resolution resolved, and they say, we, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown. And so now we have said what we're going to do, and probably the most important part of this resolution is, in fact, the last sentence. It says, and for the support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And, wouldn't we like to have our Congress have this kind of courage today.
And of course, I think that people read that today without realizing the implications, because this was the Treasonous Act, and if they were unsuccessful in their efforts, they would be captured, they would be tortured, everything they had would be seized from them. It might very well be that their families would be killed, because the British Crown was ruthless in suppressing of any revolution on the part of its subjects. And so this was basically, in some respects, like signing their own death warrants if they failed in their undertaking to bring freedom to the United States.
Yes, I mean, it's so far from politicians today who are afraid to take a position because they might not be reelected or they may go down in the polls. When they mutually pledged their lives, they literally pledged their lives and their fortunes, all of their property, and then their sacred honor. And isn't that refreshing to see the words sacred honor? And here, this is another example of inevitable writing, because you wouldn't change the order. You know, it was lives, fortunes, and the most important to the Founding Fathers was their sacred honor.
And you know, we've sort of gotten away with this from this idea of honor. Could you imagine a Bill Clinton pledging his honor? I mean, everybody would just snicker. In fact, who among our leaders today, if they were to pledge their honor, would give it any credence at all? And yet, at the time when the Declaration of Independence was written, personal honor, duty, these concepts were something that were just inherent in the people, and it was inherent in them because of their belief in God, and honor had their honor was based upon their religious beliefs, and their duty was based upon their religious beliefs. Duty, honor, country, those were concepts that men were willing to live for and to die for and to fight for, but who today is willing to fight for duty, honor, country?
No, I still think there are Americans that are willing to. As a matter of fact, some of them are doing it right now. But I do think that it's gone from the public square. It's been extracted away from our culture, and it's so important that we bring it back in an understanding for what that meant. And it's interesting that this style of writing was influenced very much by an English style called prosody, which was sort of a combination of poetry and prose, and these words were meant to be read aloud the way we're doing it. And it started with the words, you know, when in the course of human events, which was a big, broad concept, and it ends with lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, which brings a wonderful unity to the structure of this when it's read aloud. And this idea was not what today is called spin or hype. These were men of honor. Their motives and actions could withstand the closest scrutiny. And they, by putting their names on the document, the credibility that they had was so powerful that it caused a revolution with this amazing birth certificate of our nation.
And many of them did lose their lives, and many of them lost their families, and many of them lost all their property. But not one of them ever betrayed the sacred trust and their promise when they signed the Declaration of Independence.
That's right, they didn't. And it was, again, because of the fact that they had a moral consensus. They shared this theistic paradigm. They shared these self-evident truths that have been just intentionally sort of extracted away from our culture. We're not even allowed to refer to that heritage, even though when we go to Washington, D.C., we see In God We Trust engraved on the walls of both houses, just like it is on our money. We see a prayer room in the Capitol with a glass window depicting Washington in prayer. It has a quotation of Psalm 16, the Ten Commandments on the wall of the Supreme Court. Biblical quotations in the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Library of Congress, and yet we're supposed to just extract that completely from our culture and worship at the altar of Freud and Nietzsche and Hegel and Marx and John Dewey and all of this influence that came over here and polluted in a sense our culture.
And of course, these were men who really believed that freedom was worth sacrificing everything for. And people have to begin to understand that this idea of individual freedom is based upon the concept of limiting the power of the government over our lives. Liberty and limited government are inseparable. Tyranny and total government go together. And unfortunately, there are people who would destroy these concepts of liberty and replace it with an all-powerful, all-regulatory government, because these are people who really do not believe that there is a God, and they believe that only the all-powerful state can bring about a better world.
Yeah, they believe that the future of mankind, or some sort of utopian vision where there's an elite few to make decisions for the many, and it appears as though as much control as possible is asserted on all of us. And so the notion, as you well point out, of freedom and limited government, which is the essence of Americanism, is completely abandoned for a total 180-degree opposite philosophy, which is a collectivist notion of, you know, this utopian agenda and a single global authority.
And, of course, these ideas of socialism and of freedom cannot go together. They are exactly the opposite, because one involves the state regulation and the other revolves people looking after themselves. One is based upon the individual taking care of himself. The other is based upon the state taking care of the individual.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and it appears as though whenever you're trying to strengthen the almighty state, you have to remove those very pillars, those very obstacles to the almighty state, which are those two pillars that we talked about. You have to remove the concept of inalienable rights. And that's one of the very reasons that this theistic paradigm has been under attack, because it's an obstacle to an almighty state. And the same thing with the notion of limited government. That's why we constantly see the expansion of federalism, the expansion of federal agencies, the expansion and of course international expansion of bureaucracy at every level, because that's the natural tendency of government, and that will always be an attack on liberty. And it's inevitable that the normal circumstances that we have to be eternally vigilant and resist that in order to maintain our system.
Amen to that. Well, Dr. Herson, thank you so much for being with us this evening. It's been an exciting time, and when we get together again, I hope we'll be able to get started on the Constitution, its meaning, and eventually, of course, into the Bill of Rights. But that's for another evening. Thank you so very much for giving us an hour this evening. Bye-bye, and may the Lord be with you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
Great program. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Don't even think about changing that dial.